From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The wrongful conviction of Daryl Hunt in the rape and murder of Deborah Sykes raises a lot of uncomfortable questions. Those questions are brought into sharp focus in a new documentary about Hunt's legal struggle in Winston-Salem, a struggle that began more than 20 years ago. One looming question goes to the very core of our criminal justice system and the society that produced it. That's a moment from the documentary film The Trials of Daryl Hunt, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this week. Joining us now are one of the filmmakers, Annie Sundberg. Annie, welcome.
Hi.
This story begins for Daryl Hunt in 1985 when he's arrested in the murder and rape of Deborah Sykes, a white journalist working for the Winston-Salem Journal. It's a sensational crime. There had been eyewitness reports of a white woman struggling with a black man or men. So immediately this melodrama begins to set itself up in Winston-Salem. You join the story much later. It's at 1993. Is that when you...
Correct. It was in 1993. Ricky Stern, who is also the director and producer, were a filmmaking team on this. She had a friend who had been working as a private investigator with the defense on this case, and he called her and knew that she was looking for an interesting subject for a documentary. And he said, "I think you should pay attention to this case because it's a very important case for the Winston-Salem community, and we think that there's something very funny going on."
And Ricky had been somewhat familiar with this in that she was a student for a while in North Carolina, isn't that right?
Correct. Actually, she met her friend, basically. She had gone to UNC at Chapel Hill, and so she had been down in this area for, you know, I guess the previous year. And so it was interesting for her to return because this case, I think, has always been part of the backdrop of Winston-Salem as long as we've known Winston-Salem. And for her, when she got the call from Richard McGough, it was pretty compelling. And so we all traveled down. I had an old car at the time, and it was William Rexer, who was our camera person, Ricky, and an old college professor of ours, and the four of us drove down in the summer of 1993.
This case about Daryl Hunt and his culpability and all this.
Well, we went in, to be perfectly honest, we went in with a very open mind because we weren't sure what anybody's agenda was. It seemed like everybody had an agenda. The DAs had an agenda. You know, the media had an agenda down there. And we would sit in those initial hearings at the time they were called the motions for appropriate relief. And we were just discovering the case every day. And there were times when Ricky would look at me and she'd be like, "I don't know, I think maybe Hunt's guilty." You know, and Will would sit there and question it. And then we'd talk more with Mark and Larry. Mark Rabel was one of the defense attorneys, and Larry Little founded the Hunt defense team and was also very crucial to the investigation of this case. And the more we learned, the more we really did feel that there was an injustice that was occurring.
Go ahead.
But I think that's the hardest thing as a filmmaker, is that you really want to go in with an open mind, because I think if you go in with an agenda, you really can miss parts of the story along the way.
Well, was there a point at which you couldn't deny to yourself that an injustice had been done?
Well, the first time that it became really clear to us was when the boatload, the 3,000-plus pages of what's called exculpatory material was turned over to the defense. It was amazing to us that this material had not been released prior. And then when we really knew that we were onto something, was especially with the DNA. When the DNA results came back and the conviction was upheld, it was just, we really fought to get this case, to get this film made. And it was very, very difficult for us because at that point we felt strongly that an injustice was happening. But it was difficult to convince funders when Daryl had two jury trials and, you know, a refusal to reopen the case. You know, they looked at him and said he's going to spend his life in prison.
And at that point, you pretty much had to drop the project, didn't you?
We did, in essence. I mean, we basically couldn't get any funding, and I think it was very frustrating. And I know we all collectively felt like we'd let down people that we'd sort of made a commitment to. I think we'd all felt that we wanted to get this case out in the public sphere. I know through the years, we'd stayed in touch with Mark and Larry at various points as the case progressed. And obviously in 2000, we went down when the state Supreme Court appeals were denied. And then we basically, or I'm sorry, in 94, the crucial years for us for filming were 93, 94, 96, 2000, 2003. and then it's been a race to finish it.
And actually, I just found an interesting story about this. When you had to sort of drop the film, you were working with some old technology, and when you decided to revive it, you saw that you had some provocative footage without sound. Tell us that story.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest stories, because what happened in essence was that we couldn't afford to process the film, and we were shooting 16mm footage at the time, and there's a trick to keeping film alive, which is you freeze it. And so Will had come back from one of the most heartbreaking days, which was, it's a scene in the film, which you'll see, where Mark and Larry have gathered to give Daryl the news that he has lost his state Supreme Court appeal, and it was a very tight decision. It was 4-3. But when we basically found out that the case was coming back to life, when the Winston-Salem Journal was publishing articles, and we got a call that it looked like Daryl might get out, we immediately called up Will and said, what happened to that footage? We know that we have roles that we've never processed. And so at that point, we basically, you know, put it on a credit card and processed it. And it was amazing. The film survived, you know, an unbelievable number of years, 8 years in a freezer. And then it didn't have any sound, because during those years, you know, everything gets separated, and it took us more than 6 months of desperate searching.
Right, you had separate reels, actually quarter-inch tape, so you've got some film over here, and then in another box somewhere is the sound that goes with it, which you have to match up. Can't find the sound.
Exactly. So everybody now makes it all on digital video, which is so easy. And here we were, we reorganized one of the major film vaults in New York looking for our material. We looked in basements and storage lockers, and finally, Will found it in an unmarked box. And I can't tell you what it felt like to actually sit in an edit room in an old Steenbeck to watch this footage, which we hadn't seen for 8 years, and to lay the sound back to it. I mean, we were crying. I mean, Mark has tears in his eyes in that scene, and we were so thankful that we had the sound.
Well, Mark Rabel is with us now, the defense attorney for the entire period of this trial. Mark Rabel, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about that. I think that small story about the loss of the sound and its recovery in many ways is a microcosm of your entire emotional roller coaster, and certainly Daryl's throughout this ordeal.
Well, it really was. And when I saw that scene, actually, I guess I had repressed how bad it was. And there's a point when Larry Little and I are speaking to Daryl on a speakerphone in my office. And you can hear the prison noises in the background and the guards and other prisoners. And Daryl just says to thank everybody, and then Daryl's gone. And then there's a dial tone, and then there's this silence for, seems to me like 4 hours, but it was, you know, a couple of minutes. And it really was a microcosm. It was right in the middle of the case. It was the lowest point. We had lost. And so where we were going to go from there was anybody's guess.
There's a great scene in the documentary where Larry Little's being interviewed. Larry Little, the activist in Winston-Salem, an attorney who had, also a longtime friend of Daryl. We'll be talking with him later in the program. But in that scene, I think this is when you decide to do the cold hit for DNA. In other words, can we match this DNA to the list of known offenders and maybe find out who really did the crime? Call Larry Little and say, I think we've got a shot. I think we've got a chance. It's one of the moments when you think there's yet another chance. And Larry Little is shaking his head saying, man, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what we're up against here. Give it up. Leave me alone, Mark. Were there points along the way, Mark, where you said to yourself, this can't be done?
When I said it couldn't be done, no. I don't know why. I guess it's just faith or stubbornness or perhaps stupidity. But I never felt like we should give up. I always felt like at some point we could get Daryl out. And the interesting thing about Larry and I is it's in many ways a yin and yang relationship. We pushed each other and pulled each other through the years to get this done. And there were so many times when I would be optimistic and Larry would be pessimistic, or I'd be pessimistic and Larry would be optimistic. And so the night of December 19th, 2003, when we got the call that the SBI had finally made the match to the real killer, Willard Brown, I called Larry and I said, this is it. And Larry used his expletives, which is very well done in the film and actually very appropriate. The reaction of one of the audience members yesterday was Larry gave the F word the most dignified meaning they had ever heard. Yeah. And that it was the perfect explanation, because there we were, after 20 effing years, we had solved it, and the district attorney is saying, well, we always thought Hunt was involved, so now we have the guy that he did this with? And let me tell you, the rage that we felt was like nothing I have ever felt before in my life. I mean, I had been angry through the years. I'm the opposite of Daryl. I had been so angry. I had broken my fist on the courthouse door in 1994. But to hear the district attorney spit these words out that maybe Daryl is still involved, I was so angry, and it was at that point that the white ministers came on board and put the pressure on the DA to agree to.
Yeah, when you talk about the anger, we talk about Larry Little's response. Even though he had that response, he too stuck with it. So,
oh, yeah.
So the entire range of emotions is expressed, and yet ultimately the point of the film, and I think the story, is that one way or another, everybody stuck with it. Ricky Stern is the director of this film, and she joins us now from Sundance. Hello, Ricky.
Hello.
Ricky, you stuck with it as well. Were there moments in the course of doing this project where you felt that's it, it's over?
Yes, we went on a little roller coaster with them, not nearly as as emotional or as important as their roller coaster, but we were filming periodically up until about the time that the Supreme Court turned them down for their appeal, and we had a very difficult time convincing anybody that the story should be told and getting any funding to complete it.
Well, Ricky, I want to talk with you some more, and Annie Sundberg, the co-producers of the documentary film, and Mark Rabel. We'll have Daryl Hunt a little later on, and Larry Little, all talking about the case of Daryl Hunt, the trials of Daryl Hunt. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcast from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 2 years ago, almost to the day, Daryl Hunt was exonerated of the rape and murder convictions in the death of a white woman in Winston-Salem. After 18 years of wrongful imprisonment, it is now clear that police and prosecutors covered up evidence, refused to pursue other suspects. Witnesses whose testimony could have exonerated Hunt were turned away. And even after DNA evidence showed that Daryl Hunt could not have been the person who raped Deborah Sykes more than 10 years before he was released, the courts refused to release him. But he is free today, and as audiences at the Sundance Film Festival this week watch a new documentary about his wrongful imprisonment, we examine the questions the case raises. We're talking with Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg, the documentary's filmmakers, and Mark Rabel is with us as well, Daryl Hunt's defense attorney throughout the ordeal. Ricky, I understand that you studied theater while you were here in North Carolina. Tell us a little bit about the art of documentary filmmaking and whether or not drama and theater in any way play a role in that.
It does. I think that if you make a successful documentary, you're striving to tell a story dramatically, and the same elements that apply in theater and in good fiction film with dramatic arcs, or what you hope to build into your documentary filmmaking. Obviously, there's a lot of drama in this story, and our goal as documentary filmmakers was to capture it in a way that would translate on film.
Annie, you talked earlier about the danger of going in with an agenda, but once you've made up your mind, then how do you guard against this film becoming a polemic? Annie Sundberg, are you there?
Yeah. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I was just asking how you guard against the film becoming a polemic once you've made up your mind.
Oh, I think, to be honest, I think it all has to do with, that's when you start bringing in outside voices and your editor helps guide you. And I think we've always approached this case with a sense that if you really just allow these voices to be presented, I think the way we've edited the film and sort of, we did work to get interviews with the DAs and we've included, I think, We've included voices from the different sides in a way that I hope will allow both prosecutors and defense to use this film to talk about how to collectively address issues in the criminal justice system.
And how has the film been received at Sundance?
I can't tell you how thrilling it's been. I mean, this is the first time we've shared the film with an audience, and it's been moving and overwhelming. I mean, for us as filmmakers, Larry just turned to me, he said, "Did you ever think we'd get here?" It's truly remarkable. We had standing ovations. We've had extended Q&As. I think people are so thrilled to be able to meet and hear from Mark, Larry, and especially Daryl. And April, it's just been, I mean, I think she's been an added treat as well. So.
April, Daryl Hunt's wife.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Annie Sundberg, I want to thank you and your partner, Ricky Stern, the partners in making this film, the documentary film, The Trials of Daryl Hunt. I know you're at the Sundance Film Festival right now. You're all there in the same room. Daryl Hunt is with you, as well as Larry Little. And I wonder if you can put them on the phone. We've got questions for them as well.
We'd be happy to. Thank you so much.
Thanks for talking with us.
We're here with us.
Taking a look at The Trials of Daryl Hunt, a documentary that's premiering at the Sundance Film Festival. It'll go into festival for all of 2006 and be aired on HBO in 2007. Daryl Hunt, are you there?
Yes.
18 years in... Hello, how are you? Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
18 years in prison. Those years are gone forever. You're now married. You have two children. You never at any point along the way, from what I could see in this documentary and what I hear now, appeared angry. How is that possible?
Well, I tried to put all that behind me, and I never wanted to live, let anger or bitterness eat me up. I wanted to live. So, and for me today, to be able to help someone else not go through this is, for me, is I'm able to get past the 18 years of imprisonment as long as I know I can help somebody else.
I guess it's one thing to say you want to put it behind you, but when so much was in front of you, when there was seemed to be no possibility of exoneration and of the truth coming out, how do you not get angry then?
Faith in God, and it was, you know, God gives you, he works in mysterious ways, and he works through people. And he blessed me with a variety of people. Larry Little, Mark Rabel, my wife, and the community. Reverend Eversley, Reverend Mendez, you know, the list goes on and on. And you know, and my father-in-law, Colin Griggs. The list just continued to go on, so it was through that effort that I became, my faith grew stronger in God, because he was showing me that he was working. These people never gave up. They didn't know who I was, but they believed in justice, and they fought. And they continue to fight. So
you went something of a faith journey. It seems to me you are now a practicing Muslim. Is that right?
Yes.
But you weren't when you went in. Did you have a particular religious practice when you went in?
Well, I was a Baptist Christian. I was baptized in First Calvary Baptist Church in Winston-Salem. Growing up, I went to church. My grandfather and grandmother made sure I was in church every Sunday. I knew about religion, but I wasn't, I guess you can say, just focused on it,
mm-hmm.
or really understood it in the full sense.
I understand that Larry Little is with you now. Is he on the phone, and can he hear us right now, Larry?
Yes, I can hear you.
Winston-Salem activist and professor at WSSU. You were in on this from the beginning. You stayed with Daryl from the start. First of all, what made you believe in his innocence?
Well, as I've indicated several times, I had met Daryl prior to this incident. We played basketball at the old Patterson Avenue YMCA, and I remember him comporting himself in a certain way, and when he was charged with the crime, I didn't know whether he did it or not. I was surprised because I didn't see him as a person who could commit that act, just from my interacting with him at the Y. And so as a member of the city council, I remember going to see him in jail and talking to him. And he told me he was innocent. And, of course, I expected him to say that. But then I asked him a couple of tough questions, and I followed him up with some leads. And at that point, I felt strongly about it, and I went to see his lawyers, and they asked me to if I could raise money for him for a defense fund. And as I did more investigation, I was able to then go to ministers like Reverend Carlton Eversley and Reverend John Mendez in Winston-Salem and tell them about what was happening and ask them if they would help me to raise funds and things of this sort. And the more I just went on a one-man investigation type of thing and talking to witnesses, and the more witnesses I talked to, I sort of knew they were railroading Daryl, and in fact they were attempting to probably put in the gas chamber an innocent man, and my conscience just would not allow me to rest if I felt in my heart and soul he was innocent.
Well,
how could I?
It's one thing just to believe in the innocence of Daryl Hunt, but then you have to somehow believe in a criminal justice system, which up till now hasn't been famous for exonerating people in this situation.
Well, I had some experience with the Joanne Little case in North Carolina in 1975, a young black female who was charged with killing a white jailer who had brought an ice pick into her jail cell in Little Washington, North Carolina, and raped her. And I was able to help start a defense movement with her, and we were able to win that case 9 years earlier. So it sort of gave me skills to sort of help with organizing, mobilizing for Daryl. But you're correct. Seldom do you get justice from the criminal justice system. It is very difficult, and sometimes when the shoe doesn't fit, the prosecutors take the attitude, well, break the foot and force the shoe on. And unfortunately, we've allowed that to happen. And we're still seeing some problems with that in North Carolina with these prosecutors who've now gotten people on death row through perjured testimony. And yet our Bar Association doesn't deal with them as rigorously as they do lawyers who take client trust fund money. So when you have that sort of attitude where prosecutors can get away with misconduct, it doesn't make for our system being able to reform itself and deliver justice.
Another part of that criminal justice system and the way that it works, Mark Rabel, is the fact that you, when you took this case on more than 20 years ago, had never defended a murder client before.
That's right. I'd been out for 4 years, and now I'm an assistant capital defender, so that's all I do. But under the guidelines now, there's no way I would have been allowed to represent Daryl. And in retrospect, after giving a lot of thought, there's a lot of things that could have been done differently. I don't think that we could have been intimidated as much by the district attorney as we were. But I don't think even the best attorneys in the world could have overcome the lies and the fraud perpetrated in both of these trials.
I agree.
Mark, let me ask you this question first, then Larry. Have laws been broken? Is this obstruction of justice? Do there need to be new criminal charges brought against the people who tried this case initially?
Well, you use the word criminal justice, which in many respects is not an oxymoron. The justice in this case was criminal. The system absolutely did not work. We had to force it to work and embarrass it into working by calling attention to it. Will there be charges brought against the prosecutors who cheated, basically? No, the state bar takes the position that the statute of limitations has run on all that. And currently there are charges pending, or actually have been dismissed, against other prosecutors who basically lied and did not disclose evidence to juries in death penalty cases. So I don't know. It may have to be taken out of the hands of the lawyers and restored to or given to some other body. If the lawyers, you know, Larry and I are both lawyers, if we can't control ourselves, I don't know what to do. But it's very, very distressing right now, and hopefully the Supreme Court can overturn the bar's decision in this recent case against these other prosecutors.
Larry Little, you heard Mark Rabel say it didn't work and we forced it to work. But do you see this as a kind of a breakdown of the system, or do you see some of these inequities and injustices at this point built into the system?
Yeah, it's systemic. It is not just some sort of exception to the rule. You have prosecutors who go into court with the idea that they're going to win. In fact, you hear them sometimes joking in the courtroom that they can convict the guilty with no problem. It just takes a little bit more effort to convict the innocent, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you have a culture that has developed around a lot of prosecutors where they just because they are able to do these things and they go unscathed. And so it's systemic in the system, and it's obviously got to be reformed. And hopefully, and this is one of the things I think is potentially beautiful for this case, the people from HBO and others are saying that this documentary ought to be shown in all the law schools in the United States, because I think it could do something to raise the level of consciousness. This ought to be shown as part, when you go to law school, you have to take a course in ethics. And this ought to be shown, a required showing and viewing for all ethic courses in law school, so that people can begin to see that when you go through these great efforts to convict someone who's innocent, you're leaving the guilty person on the street, you're leaving the public at risk from further attacks. In this case, we find that this person who ultimately is responsible for Deborah Sykes' murder is probably involved with a lot of other things. So the public is disturbed by this sort of prosecutorial misconduct. And hopefully this film will do a lot to educate a lot of people and make us all sit down, because that's one thing to make a mistake. But to be so arrogant as to not admit your mistake and to put forth information that you know is not accurate, and yet to get a conviction of a person and possibly end their life, that's criminal, that's unconscious, and we have to do something to change the culture that exists with far too many prosecutors.
Daryl Hunt, as you went through this process, we talked about the fact that you never seemed to become angry or bitter throughout the entire process. Tell me if you believe that you are going to be exonerated and that the truth would finally be told, or if you simply resigned yourself to the fact that you are going to have to live with this injustice.
I never resigned myself to the fact that I was going to have to live with it. I always believed that the truth would come out one day. I just prayed that I would be alive to see it. And because that was my faith. I mean, I believe and still believe strongly in God. And God, in this case, in my life, if God's hand was not there, then none of this would be possible. I mean, I would still be in prison. I'd probably be on death row. Willa Brown, if he would have died years ago, I'd still be in prison today.
Willard Brown is the man who ultimately confessed to the crime.
Yes. And so it's so many things that man didn't do, but God's hand, it was a higher power.
And praying that you would be alive to see this day is no mean prayer, given the fact that there were actually threats on your life, and you believe a contract put on your on you while you're in prison.
Yes. There were several. But, again, even there, when I think about it and think back to those times of walking through the prison dormitories and trying to sleep at night, it was God's hand that got it and protected me, because it was inmates that actually stayed up at night just so I could get an hour worth of sleep.
So you had inmates protecting you on the one hand, but you think that guards, on the other hand, may have been bribing or paying inmates.
Yes, I know for a fact that they was, but that was the system.
Larry Little, this is certainly a complex case. To what extent do you, as you watch this case unfold and see the turns that the prosecution took to discourage witnesses, to hide evidence, to what extent do you think racism played a part, and how much of it is prosecutors wanting then to protect their reputation and simply not being able to admit a mistake?
Well, I think initially, prior to Daryl's case, do you know there had been no black police officers had in the Central Investigative Unit of the Winston-Salem Police Department? Mm. They did not have blacks in Central Investigation. It was basically all white males club. And so you could begin to see the racism that obviously developed from there. But it's not just restricted to whites, because at one point, as the city council person, I was able to get the city manager to make some moves with the police department, and at one point they had a black police officer, Michael McCoy, put in charge of the investigation to some degree, and what he essentially did was use it It was not a question of black and white. It was a thin blue line. And what he did to Durrell was as bad as what a number of the white police officers did. And he did it because he knew he would ingratiate himself with the powers to be in the police department, and he was able to move himself all the way up the chain of command. Mm. So what you have when you have this blind ambition for status and for power, sometimes that knows no color. And I think the thing with the prosecutors, often they want to parlay their tough-on-crime images to higher political offices and things of this sort. And so it's gotten to be sort of a charade. And quite frankly, I think we all have to sit back and have a conscience and say, look, we have to at some point give an accounting if we have a belief in a creator for our actions. And I think sometimes it just requires some soul-searching. The prosecutors who handled this case initially, even to this day, don't want to acknowledge that they've made a mistake. And they search for every kind of way. And to be honest with you, we've been very critical of Thomas Keefe because we felt he could have gotten to this point back in 1994 when the DNA evidence came back 100% excluding Durrell Hunt as a depositor of the spermatozoa. But I'll be honest with you, Tom Keefe, he probably was being encouraged by the previous prosecutors in the case, still with our finding of Willard Brown, to hold to the position that Willard Brown did it along with Durrell Hunt. And that indeed was what he was trying to say. But as Mark indicated earlier, we came up with an idea to get the white ministers up front, plain and simple. And when we got the white ministers to right. go along with the black ministers, I think we were able to neuter that dog of racism so that it wouldn't hunt anymore.
We want to talk more about that and about the community's response and its role in all of this as we continue our conversation about the documentary and the ordeal of Durrell Hunt. And your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour about the justice system in North Carolina and whether or not anything has changed in the 20 years since Durrell Hunt was wrongfully convicted. With us today from the Sundance Film Festival are Larry Little and Durrell Hunt. And joining us a little later will be Winston-Salem Journal reporter Phoebe Zerwick. You can join us as well by calling us at 877-962-9862, particularly if you're in Winston-Salem. We'd like to know if you think race relations have changed since Durrell Hunt was convicted. Has the criminal justice system changed? Does it need to? 877-962-9862. Larry Little, you said something to one of the film producers, either to Ricky Stern or Annie Sundberg, now that you're there at Sundance with a film and a freed Durrell Hunt, do you think we ever would have gotten to this point? Did you think, Larry Little, you'd ever get to this point?
I was just talking to Annie. I didn't know if we were going to get to this point. In fact, I was afraid. I was telling I had done a will a few years back. I had undergone some heart problems, and I wasn't sure that I was going to make it. And I had made out a will to leave Durrell something in my will because I didn't know if I would live to see the day that that he would get out. And I wanted to make certain that there was some money for him so that he, if he stayed in prison, he still had some funds. And so, quite frankly, I was never going to give up. I just didn't know if we would get to see this day. And as we were sitting here in Park City at the Sundance Festival, I'm looking out over a ski resort, and it's just gorgeous, and just meeting all the people and seeing what you put 20 years of your life into get a chance to be displayed to people all over the world. It's just incredible, and sometimes I'm not sure that I'm not dreaming, and I'm not going to be slapped and say, wake up, this was a dream you're on. But quite frankly, it's been just absolutely beautiful. And I mentioned this last evening when I spoke. When Durrell got out, I had a friend of mine, Donna Ingram, to call me, and she said, Larry, not only is Durrell released, you've released from prison too, because quite frankly, Mark and I, we never let go, and even though we were not physically incarcerated with Durrell, emotionally and mentally, psychologically, we were there with him, and so we couldn't let it go, so we were sort of imprisoned ourselves, and so this is a chance for both of us to be able to to see the fruits of this hard labor. And I tell people that we're now sort of like looked at as heroes, but we caught hell for 20 years
I want to ask Mark Rabel about that. One last question, Mark, because I know you have to go. It's a busy schedule there at Sundance, but you have had a chance to talk with people. How has that been for you? What kind of response has this film gotten?
It's very uplifting to hear the audience reaction. One young lady said that she was going to reactivate her bar card. It was such an inspiration to her.
This is an inert attorney, an inactive attorney. Is that it?
Right.
Yeah.
So, and you know, it's good to finally have something that gives lawyers like me and Larry a good name. You know, that we were able to stick with it. But we hope that and believe the documentary is going to force some changes to be made, mostly just by raising consciousness about these issues and creating the awareness that people need to have.
Defense Attorney Mark Rabel, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
You can join the conversation by calling us at 877-962-9862 as we talk about the trials of Daryl Hunt with Daryl Hunt today and Attorney Larry Little from Winston-Salem. They are both now at the Sundance Film Festival, where a documentary about the ordeal is being screened even as we speak. Well, let's go to the phones. Danny's on the line from Greensboro. Hello, Danny.
Hello. I just really had a comment and a question. The back in the early 90s, I actually had a job where I worked with Miss Sykes' mother, and at that time, you know, she would speak about it just only very rarely. But when she did, she had such a sense of just being completely positive that Mr. Hunt was guilty, and that. And that she didn't care what anybody said or anybody thought, but she knew in her heart that he was guilty. And I was just wondering if the prosecution has some responsibility or actually works to convince the family members, even when they know that that being dishonest, that that a particular person is guilty and need that to help them.
Well, let's get a response. Let's get a response, Danny. Thank you for the question, Danny. Larry Little, do you think there is an effort to sort of work with the families to make them to increase the pathos in the case?
Well, that's one of the sad things about the case. One of my dreams had been that one day we would find the truth, and Miss Jefferson, Deborah Sykes' mother, would go up to Daryl and give him a hug. And say and he would say, "You don't have to apologize, Miss Jefferson, for anything." I knew that's what Daryl would have said, but quite frankly, she has been lied to by the police department and the and some of the prosecutors for so long that it's going to take. I don't know if she's going to be able to get there. But one of the things we found out when the city manager ordered an investigation after the first conviction, we got the October 12th letter, where Donald Tisdale, the prosecutor, said that he had the opportunity to talk to Miss Jefferson, and the police had told him, this was prior to the first trial, that they had a strong case, and he said he didn't find it amusing to have to tell her the truth, that they didn't have a solid case of any kind, and that they were in trouble. So he, in this private letter that he wrote to the police chief, Masson at the time, he said he told her even before the trial that they had no case of any kind and they were in trouble.
And yet
he proceeded to try this case.
Yeah, and she did come to believe, and that's a question I want to put to Daryl Hunt, came to believe even to the point that we're talking about Deborah Sykes' mother, Evelyn Jefferson, that even when Willard Brown had his DNA had matched the DNA at the crime scene and he had confessed, Evelyn Jefferson, at your exoneration hearing, stood up and said she believes that you were still guilty, Daryl Hunt, that you did it, even though she had the confession of the guilty party. And I wonder at that moment what you were thinking, because we'll talk about your actual response and what you said to her in a moment. But while she was saying that, what was going through your mind?
Well, basically what I said, and I understand that for 20 years she had been lied to, and I know how that feels to be lied to about something, and I know how it feels to lose someone that you love. I lost my mother, And the person that killed my mother didn't do it in time. But so I understand how a person feels to lose someone, and to lose someone and then be lied to for 20 years. You need something to hold on to.
So you can empathize. Did you just say that your mother was murdered and the killer was never found?
They was found, but they didn't do it in time.
I see. Well, joining us now is reporter Phoebe Zerwick. Phoebe is a reporter for the Winston-Salem Journal, whose eight-part series in the paper, in many ways revived the story back in 2003, and she joins us now. Hello, Phoebe.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit about this as we talk about the emotions that were aroused in Winston-Salem and the idea that even if you have a guilty party, people's minds are so set that they find it hard to believe that the initial story wasn't true. Is that the case today in Winston-Salem? Are people coming to terms with the fact that injustice has been done, or are they on the same sides of the trench?
Oh, I think Mr. Hunt's exoneration has helped a lot of people see how the court system can get things wrong and how police can make mistakes. There's certainly people in Winston-Salem who still believe he had something to do with the crime, but his case and other cases in North Carolina have certainly led to changes in the justice system and I think created jurors who are more skeptical of police and prosecutors.
Do you think things have changed much in Winston-Salem in
particular? As a result of his exoneration?
Yes.
You mean kind of daily life and
attitudes, racial attitudes, and also in the court system? Is there more talk about among lawyers and judges about having to reform?
Things have definitely changed in the court system, and there have been cases that where people charged with killings have been acquitted, and lawyers on both sides think that it has to do with, in part, with Hunt's case. It's very hard to measure, you know, racial attitudes. So I don't know how to answer the broader question.
Larry Little, what's your sense of that?
Well, I think in the Winston-Salem Police Department, the new police chief, Pat Norris, is undertaking some changes in the way they do a number of things, particularly with the identification process and things of this sort. There have been a number of people, of white people, who have spoken to me and said they felt embarrassed and ashamed that they just followed pretty much what the sentiment was, that a number of people felt he was guilty. The black community, because we had the Winston-Salem Chronicle newspaper, a black newspaper, and a black radio station, WAAA, that kept the people informed, knew pretty much all along that he was innocent, and they contributed a substantial amount of money. And there were some in the white community that felt the same way, but basically people formed their ideas based on what the newspaper reports were. And I guess, quite frankly, I wish we had had Phoebe Zerrick back 20 years ago doing these kind of stories, because I think that atmosphere, her writing in this case, I think has been very, very critical in helping to change the attitudes, I think, of a lot of people, but it's hard for people to admit that they made mistakes.
Well, let me talk about that for just a minute with Phoebe, because not only was the public fooled and a jury fooled twice, the media was fooled. The media was taken for a ride on this. But given how court cases and legal cases are covered, Phoebe, do you think there was any other way to cover this thing beginning in 1985? Could the press have been more aggressive?
I mean, I think we did, basically what newspapers do when they're covering legal cases. And we ran down leads and we presented both sides, and we presented it, though, as two valid sides to a case.
And so, you are very dependent on essentially the police and the prosecutors. That's where your news is coming from.
I know we didn't run down everything, but we certainly wrote about a lot of the issues that Larry Little, for example, was raising at the time. But we presented it in a very neutral way. Here's what Larry Little says, or here's what Mark Wrabel says, and then here's what the police said. And we never took the time to investigate this from beginning to end on our own. And I think that's the difference in what we were able to do a couple of years ago.
Yeah, you can put some dots together that just don't connect. Is the
exactly.
Point.
In this case in particular was so complicated that I think it really took laying it out in all of its intricacies for readers to really be able to see where the holes were.
Daryl Hunt, we talked a little bit about Winston-Salem and how it may have changed. What changes have you noticed since the time that you were serving in prison?
I think it's changed a lot. Just me being out, talking to different people, and people coming up to me and talking and being able to see the unity or the effort that is being made to unify everybody in the community. Where there's not only in the religious bodies, but just across the racial lines itself, the thing that Mayor Jones is doing with the racial healing, and I think a lot has changed for the better.
Tell us a little bit about your life now. You're married, you have two children. Tell us what you're doing.
I'm married, I have two children, and I started the project, the Daryl Hunt Project for Freedom and Justice, to help innocent people who are in prison get out of prison, to help people re-enter society from prison, get readjusted back to society. We help them try to help them find jobs, working with other groups in the city to make those groups better.
What kind of support have you gotten from the community in Winston-Salem for your project?
I've gotten great support. The Winston-Salem Foundation has given us grants, and the community itself has been supportive in helping with different projects. Programs that we're trying to establish to help people coming out of prison get readjusted.
One of the points that you made is that while you had a very high-profile case and it was a murder case, there are a lot of people serving who may not are in prison for smaller offenses, lesser offenses, who may also be wrongfully convicted, and this has an equally devastating impact on their lives.
Yes, because it's DNA, and if there's no DNA, it's harder to prove innocence. And it's just as unfair because they're innocent and they're sitting in prison. And as Dr. Little said earlier, it's sad because the people that actually committed the crime who should be in prison is out here continually to do the things that the person in prison who's innocent is accused of. So,
well, I want to get one quick question to Larry and Phoebe as well. Larry, do you think this could happen again?
Oh, yes, and it's going to happen again because, to say the least, our system is not infallible, but it's going to happen again because there's just still in the process, that mindset that exists, I think, in a culture, climate, a culture that exists in prosecutors' offices to win. And we even have instances in one case, Winston-Salem, with the Donald Hardy case, a young man who confessed to a robbery that he didn't commit.
All right. Well, we are out of time, but Larry Little, I want to thank you. Phoebe Zerwick, a reporter
thank
for
you.
The Winston-Salem Journal, thank you very much. And Daryl Hunt, the founder of the Daryl Hunt Project, thank you very much, Daryl, for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about this program, you can drop us an email at sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.